Are you ready to take your business to the next level? Every day, there are countless books and articles that are published offering the key on how to make your business a success. It's easy to feel overwhelmed trying to keep up and run your business. That's why Deb Creer created the Business Power Hour. Keep up on the latest trends, best practices, and techniques for how to make your business a success. Let the Business Power Hour do the heavy work for you.
Good morning, good morning. I am Deb Creer, and I am passionate about giving professionals the tools that they need to make themselves and their businesses as successful as possible. And we're going to have so much fun today because we're going to be talking about a subject that I know zero about. Actually, I know more about it because I read our guest's book, and it was great information, but I still really don't know an awful lot about this subject. But it's a fascinating subject, especially with everything that's going on right now, not only in the United States, but in the world. I mean, it's just something that really is something that's happening everywhere. So please join me in welcoming my guest to our program today, Dr. Jim White. So welcome, Dr. White.
My pleasure, Deb. Pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this time that we're going to have an opportunity to spend together.
Perfect. Well, let me tell people just a little bit about you, and then we'll jump into this because it really is going to be a fascinating discussion. So Jim White, PhD, is the CEO of 13 different companies, all aligned in the agriculture industry, including Post Harvest Technologies, Growers Ice Company, and PhD Opportunity Fund. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering, an MBA, and a doctorate in psychology and organizational behavior. Over his lifetime, he has bought and sold 23 companies operating in 44 countries and has generated over $1.8 billion with a B dollars. Dr. White's most recent best-selling book is Opportunity Investing: How to Revitalize Urban and Rural Communities with Opportunity Funds. It is a rallying cry to invest in opportunity zones as a way to renew struggling communities across the nation. So again, Dr. White, welcome.
Thank you so much, Deb. Thank you. Very, very, very kind. As I often say, when you have as many decades as I continue to build, the resume gets a little longer.
I know, and it's always so fascinating. And that's actually one of my first questions is, tell us how you got to where you are today, because you have had a very diverse and varied career. I mean, just looking at your different degrees, it's interesting. But how is it that you discovered that this is your passion in life?
What a great question! What a great question to lead with. And as I said, with the decades, we could probably end up taking 3 or 4 days or answering that question. So we're limited in time.
That's why I set a timer, because I know I could just listen forever.
Mm-hmm. I often start answering that question the following way. I am what sometimes I refer to as a throwaway kid. And what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I'm from rural, poorer than poor, mm-hmm. South Carolina. Okay. Actually born in Toccoa, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And was abandoned at 5 years old.
Wow.
And I've only become comfortable telling this story just in recent years, mm-hmm. because of the personal nature of it. Mm-hmm. But as I progress, I've said, maybe I'm not filling in all the pieces that's necessary.
And it has made you who you are.
It has. And I remember, I know what hunger is. Mm-hmm. I know what not having any heat. I didn't know what a childhood was. Mm-hmm. And so that started. And I remember that. And I was chatting before we went on air. Mm-hmm. I'll be 72 at the end of the month, in September. And I remember those days like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. So it did set a foundation of survival, often mm-hmm. talk about survival genes. Mm-hmm. At 8 years old, I was the provider for my brothers and sisters.
Wow.
At eight. Mm-hmm. Literally, since you're in Atlanta, Georgia, and given no promotion here, but Coca-Cola. I picked up Coke bottles in those days.
And for the 8.5 cents, whatever it was.
Exactly, whatever that had. And return them to the store. And so that was my first business, right? Fast forward it. At 12 years old, I met my father for the first time at 12.
That would have been interesting.
Oh, wow. and we'll forget it. 1958, I was living with my grandparents in Salem, South Carolina. Rural, no electricity, well water. I was standing at the well drawing water. Most people don't know what I'm talking about.
You were pumping.
Pumping water. And this huge car came down this one dirt road, and my grandfather came to me, and he says, that's your father, and you're going to go live with him now.
Whoa.
And literally, I went from where I was standing into the car, not a thing on my back, and I went to live with my father, which had remarried. And as kids, we know when we're not welcome. We know energetically when nobody wants you around, and that was the case. But at 12, I realized this was a better life than what I had.
That's
really interesting. As the decades have progressed, and I've started buying companies and started coaching, I always go back. You got to have that vision. You got to have that plan. So I was always planning. So at 12, I put a plan together. At 16, I'm going to be able in a position to be self-sufficient. My father was a crane operator working in the construction industry. So I started to go to work with him during the summers, and I learned how to operate machinery. And I became a crane operator. And then I worked at gas stations to become a mechanic. And a lot of the, in those days, people would show up and become your extended family. So all the lessons that I learned about discipline and hard work and integrity meaning do what you say and mean what you say and actually follow through with what you say.
That blue collar work ethic.
Absolutely. And then as at 16, I ended up having to leave school in the 10th grade. And that shocks a lot of people, especially in later in life with the education that I ended up. So at 16, I left home and started working construction and on the interstate system around Atlanta, Georgia, quite frankly. And then I went to Miami and worked for a contractor there. And in the 60s, I was sitting on my crane one Friday afternoon, and Vietnam was in the height. And I got off my crane, went down to an Army recruiting station in Hialeah, Florida, and walked in and said, I want to join the Army.
Wow. So you enlisted.
I did. I enlisted.
Well, good for you.
I did. And I said to the recruiter, I said, I got two conditions, and for your listeners, and I know your show is made up of a lot of entrepreneurs and other businesses and probably a lot of veterans as well, and they're going to chuckle about what I'm about to say. When you offer a condition to a Army recruiter,
they're like, the only thing worse would have been if you were telling a Marine recruiter, right?
Exactly. And I said, my condition is I want to go to Vietnam. And I want special forces.
Wow. And because I would have thought they would have said, you're going to be in construction. I mean, that's clearly,
Exactly. And it's interesting. And he said, I can absolutely guarantee, number one, you will go to Vietnam. I guarantee that. So I went in and to Fort Jackson with my basic. Then I, to my disappointment, I was sent to Fort Littlewood, Missouri, to be a combat engineer. And that was doing forward bases because of my construction background. And minefield demolition and those type of things. And then after that, I had an opportunity then to go to jump school and then to ranger school at Fort Benning. Mm-hmm. So I made that transition there. So I went to Vietnam, and I credit my foundation to the military, the training, the discipline.
Right.
And I remember coming out of the first day in basic, walked in one door and all types of hair, and walked out the other door, and we all looked the same.
You were shorn off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that message was, that was the first time in my life that I ever felt equal.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I looked around, and we had people that were drafted. Mm-hmm. We got very few people like myself that would volunteer in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we had people from Yale and the Ivy League and Alabama and Auburn and Georgia Tech and University of Georgia. And you got this kid here that dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. But I looked around at my peers and I said, I'm equal. I can do this. Mm-hmm. We got a level playing field. So I started to excel. I set certain goals, and I wanted to win this. And then I took my GED, and then I started studying, and I clapped out of the first year of the college. And then I went to Vietnam. I had two tours of Vietnam and two tours. And I went as an enlisted, and then I got a direct field commission. And got out of the Army. I got injured, got out of the Army in 1971, and came back to Atlanta, Georgia, and went in the Georgia National Guard, and started to had to go to work. And I went to work for a contractor, and I was a working foreman on a bridge across the Chattahoochee River out in Little Green, Georgia. My battalion commander was very supportive, and he says, you got to further your education. Mm-hmm. You got.
And there is that little thing called the GI Bill.
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly, and I'm saying, there's no way. And so with a lot of support, I applied to Georgia Tech. Mm-hmm. And to my surprise, I got accepted. Mm-hmm. And so I entered their civil engineering program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And probably the toughest thing I ever did, because I was not really prepared for all the foundational work that you need. Mm-hmm. We studied. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I graduated and went to work for a contractor dealership in Decatur, Georgia. Mm. And then Ingersoll Rand Company was a large company, and they recruited me as the sales engineer. And I just started to excel it. My promotion started to come in extremely rapid, very focused. Ingersoll Rand sent me to school for my MBA. They paid for that, so I received that. Then I went in the international group. So I went to Saudi Arabia. I was in Saudi for 3 years, the Middle Eastern manager, and then got promoted to vice president for the construction and mining group for Ingersoll Rand. And went to Woodcliff Lakes, New Jersey, had no debt, had money in the bank, had this beautiful office in the corner office in this huge corporate park. And I will never forget, one Monday morning I showed up and I sat in my office and I said, what am I doing here? I'm miserable. So Ingersoll Rand had a division underperforming, and I went to the chairman of the board and I said, I'd like to buy it.
Ooh, not run it, buy it.
Buy it. So the advice I give people, if you ever go to your employer and suggest that you want to buy something from it and it fails, you may want to have your resume current.
So this is true.
So that's when I entered into my first foray in acquisitions, merger, deal structure. And fortunately, it did not materialize. And being a younger and a little bit more aggressive, I'm going to use that word, in those days, probably the ego factor was a little higher than it should have been. And so I resigned from Ingersoll Rand and started my first business in 1980 in Washington, D.C. Well, what was that? We had developed well, Ingersoll Rand had people to the corporate officers do this bad thing called lobbying in Washington. Mm-hmm. And so we all had our turn. Mm-hmm. And I loved it when I had, I spent about 6 years understanding, knocking on the door at World Bank and Ex-Im Bank and learning how to do project finance and putting all that together. Mm-hmm. So that's how I started my first company. I started the first company, going to some of the customers that we had, customers, small business defined as 200 million or less, that were looking to expand their markets to the third world country.
And which you had experience with. Which
I had experience. So I said, I can do this for you. I can work. And let me be your middle. I didn't know what to call us. So we said, we're consultants. And so I started working with the companies, and I got a huge break with a firm not too far years ago from a Blunt, B-L-O-U-N-T Construction, actually in Montgomery, Alabama, which started in the right after World War II. And so they had a project in Nigeria was underperforming, so I convinced them that I was the answer to all their problems. And so I went to Nigeria, did that project. Became CEO of Blunt World Trade and for a period of time, and then started buying and selling companies around the world. So I ended up buying 10 in a 10-year period of time. As you said in the introduction, we operated in 43 countries, and the one that was the largest I purchased was in Belgium, called ASAC Centrifugal Pumps. Was a 100-year-old company. And I ended up acquiring it, and we had 32% of the OPEC market in the Middle East of transfer pumps, big pump. So I took it and ended up selling it in 1991 and retired, and that lasted 24 hours. And
you thought, nah, that's boring.
Yeah, 24 hours, and then I. We started getting requests from different executive teams around the world. Come tell us how you did this deal. How did you trip this deal? How did you do that? So I, you know, my ego was stroked again. And, and so I started speaking engagements, did a lot of speaking. And then I woke up and I said, I got another business in the making. So I'm a pat rack. So I took all of the things that worked and didn't work. I created a curriculum called Circle Success. It's a one-year leadership management process. And so I started working with the executives. And before I knew it, the company was 25 years old. And so I had 162 consultants worldwide. We had a very specific niche. We developed a reputation. If you're in trouble, if your company's in trouble like that, we were to go to. We became that the toughest of the tough, the worst of the worst, and situations that we would come into. So we fast forward to your question about how did I get involved in opportunity investing? Well, one of the family members and major shareholders with the company we're involved in now, actually, we work together as, as consultants. And so these companies, Growers Eyes, Post Harvest Technologies, that you mentioned in the introduction, started in 1936. 1936 in Salinas, California. And Salinas, California is referred to as the salad bowl of the world. I mean, people realize, right? It is huge. So it was a large family, fourth generation. And as you well know, with all the work that you've done and interviews done over the years, it's very rare that a family-owned business is going to make it past the second, maybe third generation.
Right. Yeah, they're like, nah, I'm going to go do something else.
Right. So so I was asked if I would come and take a look at their company and see what we could do to improve them. And it was more of that psychology thing, and which is the other part of the degree. I decided when I was 55 to go back to school.
And I love it.
55. When I went back to school to work on, because I'm coaching, I felt that, yeah, I was pretty good at it intuitively, but I felt someone like, I'm going to use this lightly, kind of like a fraud a little bit. Mm-hmm. I wasn't consensually mm-hmm. about it, but I had to. So I wanted to go back to school, get the mm-hmm. credentials so I can have the credibility. Right. If I'm talking to someone, mm-hmm. Not only for the years of experience, but they've got some clinical mm-hmm. right. Support behind mm-hmm. it. So that's the reason I went back and worked on my PhD, mm-hmm. which took me forever to complete, which was done in 2005. And so that was the educational piece. So we started looking at these companies and Growers Ice in 2016. Mm-hmm. And it was brutal. 2017, it was probably one of the most brutal engagements. Brutal meaning you had family members that did not like each other. It was just toxic, mm-hmm. toxic. Mm-hmm. And I get myself in trouble here, but very, very, very toxic. Mm-hmm. And so we worked through a lot of different changes. Mm-hmm. 2017, then I started making a lot of reorganization. So mm-hmm. in December 2017, the TCJA, the Tax Cut Job Act, mm-hmm. Was passed. Mm-hmm. I looked at the bill, followed the legislation, mm-hmm. and I looked at my initial reaction was, man, what a bad bill. Jesus, what are we doing here, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then I started reading it, and I need to get a life because I'm probably the only one that reads tax code.
Yeah, I don't think even sometimes tax attorneys and accountants read all of it.
And then. So on page 130 of this legislation, identified opportunity zones. I said, interesting. Mm-hmm. So I was just fascinated mm-hmm. because I got this brain. I love business. I love mm-hmm. the entrepreneur. And at the same time, I got this other side of the brain. I like social justice.
Right, right. So helping people.
Mm-hmm. Helping people, being able to do that. Mm-hmm. So all of the businesses that I had the pleasure to acquire or run as CEO, mm-hmm. it's always that magic sauce mm-hmm. right in the middle. Mm-hmm. How can we, I think we've done a great job as leaders, as mm-hmm. CEOs, if we can look at our companies and say, man, that employee is progressing, they got a career, I want to have more than just a job.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And actually mean it. Mm-hmm. Don't just clips, actually mean it. I'm very passionate about that. Mm-hmm. Every company I'm involved in, I'm always trying to see how we can structure it. I don't like to, when people say the minimum wage, it drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. People need to be able to live in a quality of life that they choose to live. Right. And we, as business leaders, we got to find a way to be able to meet in the middle, if you
right.
will.
Well, and make money as a business. I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, you can't give it all away.
You cannot give it all away. And that is that magic sauce. And I am a go-oriented guy. Mm-hmm. And if you would ask my staff today, the only thing I hear from the boss is, did you meet your numbers? Mm-hmm. Did you meet your number? Mm-hmm. Did you meet your numbers? And that is an ongoing. And then I communicate, this is the reason this is so important. Mm-hmm. Unless we can give the returns that's necessary to the shareholders, that's taking a risk, mm-hmm. and at the same time have enough money to continue to invest in our businesses, mm-hmm. continue to grow in our businesses, if we don't get all of those legs on this stool mm-hmm. set in the same way, we can't help anybody.
Right.
We can't help anybody. Very, very, very straightforward. It's not that complex, right? Mm-hmm. But as you well know, I mean, there's so many people that don't look at it. We get mm-hmm. so focused mm-hmm. and what we're doing today. And it's just like, maybe we're stretched too far. Maybe we don't have a good business model. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're not using the technology. Mm-hmm. And I know that's one of the things that you did many years ago when you started the show was highlighting how you can use social media. Mm-hmm. We're talking about that. All those tools. Mm-hmm. that you're doing on the show and the hard skills, right? So you got right. to have mm-hmm. hard skills and then you got to have your soft skills. Mm-hmm. So February 2018, I established PHT Opportunity Fund. Mm-hmm. Somewhat selfish because our 28-acre campus, as we refer to it in Salinas. We have 300,000 square feet of cold storage facility and what we call another process called pre-cooling. Well, pre-cooling is this. If you have vegetables in the field, you got to get it to a field, get it facility, and get the heat out of it to prolong shelf life, and then you store it. So, as I said, this campus has been around since 1936. It's had additions and additions. It's so inefficient. It's, I mean, everything about it was just like a maze. And so I started looking at how do we improve it? How do we update it? So that's the reason the qualified opportunity zones became so important to him, because we are in a qualified opportunity zone. So we wrote the book.
Literally.
Literally. We wrote the book. We wrote the book and started writing the book in April of 2019. And because Treasury, you know, it's like the Wild West. The rules were, you know, were being developed. And so I wanted to bring clarity to it. And because it's so important. There's over 35 million Americans that live in these qualified opportunity zones. 35 million Americans in these deprived. 35 million Americans, not only in urban, but the rural areas. I'm one of those people that actually think that we can bring manufacturing back to the United States. Actually one of those people to think all of these plants that were closed, we can't open them again. So that's my passion between opportunity, opportunity invested and opportunity zones.
Right. So what specifically is a qualified opportunity zone?
Specifically, a zone, the criteria is this. If you have the median income in a particular census tract, and let's say that the area income is, say, if it falls below, say, 60%, 40% in that area, that's a threshold that says that income is below the median. And therefore, that has an opportunity to become as a designated certified opportunity zone. And it works two ways. The Treasury does the certification, but each state governor can designate, has a limited designate.
So 25%. Right, because it would vary from state to state.
It was. So we got that combination. So currently, as we speak, there's pushing about 8,800 certified opportunity zones in the United States and the territories today. Now, so that's the criteria of what a zone is. Now, why is this initiative so important? And as I said, the TCJA, if I can speak.
Too many acronyms. It's the government.
Absolutely. The bill itself, I mean, we got some improvement. We can all pose an improved bill. But the intent, once again, were you a Republican, Democrat, I don't really care. It's all about what we can do for America. This is a good initiative because we have on the sidelines over $6 trillion of unrealized capital gains on the sidelines.
Wow.
Okay, big deal. We have 35 million Americans that reside in these zones, and now in the time of COVID-19 and all the job losses,
it's going to grow.
It's going to grow. Absolutely, Deb. It's going to grow. And so the incentive is this. The incentive. Okay. Miss Investor, if you have capital gains, and if you invest in a qualified opportunity fund, and I'm going to speak now prior to December 31, 2021, you can reduce your basis that you owe to the IRS by 10%.
Wow.
Then the taxes that you owe, you do not have to pay those until April of 2027. So then, okay, Miss Investor, institutional investors. Mm-hmm. If you keep your money in the fund for 10 years, all the appreciation mm-hmm. from that fund is tax-free mm-hmm. exit. Mm-hmm. So it's a big deal. So it's not, and this program cost to Treasury to taxpayers about 15 cents for every dollar invested. Mm-hmm. Other programs that we have in the United States mm-hmm. runs from 18 to 20 cents. So mm-hmm. the numbers are
right. It's a good number. Mm-hmm.
Good mm-hmm. number, right? So you got all of these rules, and there's so many opportunities mm-hmm. for small businesses. Mm-hmm. And on our website, PhD Opportunity Fund, we created a map. Mm-hmm. And you could go to the map. Any mm-hmm. of your listeners could go to the map, and they may be listening to the show, mm-hmm. and they say, is my business in the qualified opportunity mm-hmm. zone? Mm-hmm. So that would be the first thing I would say to mm-hmm. everybody. Check out if you're in the opportunity zone and you're looking to grow, maybe you're looking to expand. Mm-hmm. Well, first to determine that. Then maybe if you don't have a business plan, let's put a business plan together, mm-hmm. and then you can start pitch into funds
right
that has interest in your asset class. Mm-hmm. So and that's what I wanted to accomplish mm-hmm. through writing the book. And I know I gave a long answer to your initial question, mm-hmm. and so I will take a breath there.
Well, and it's interesting. I've got the map open, and it's incredible how much there is, and it's funny, out on the east, there's lots of little small areas. And then, of course, in the west, there's large areas. Right. And my understanding is that, in essence, these are areas that are a depressed area for a variety of reasons. And we'll talk about some of those. But we want to encourage businesses to come in.
Correct.
And so, there's obviously a variety of ways to do this, not the least of which is, the fact that, you can get tax incentives, some things like that. And so, but there's a catch-22. And you talk about this in your book, which is, again, opportunity investing. And, because an area that's qualifying as an opportunity zone, I mentioned, is depressed. So that means probably crime is up.
Right.
Education and healthcare might be down. Right. A variety of things that's what makes it a depressed area.
Right.
So a lot of businesses are thinking, well, why would I want to invest there? Why would I want to build there? There aren't even people there that I want to hire.
Right.
So that ends up being one of the biggest hurdles. How do you work through that?
Yeah. What great point. And I spent so much time and writing that portion. How we work through it I'll do firsthand, because it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I not only wrote the book, but I'm actually doing what I mm-hmm. what I suggest for them, our business. And what we're doing, and we partner with local community, I'm going to be more specific, nonprofits.
Right.
And job programs, mm-hmm. And also invest in rehab, mm-hmm. Community outreach, at-risk youth. Mm-hmm. All of those things are real issues. Mm-hmm. And but challenges, is that easy? No. I feel like sometimes I'm pushing one big snowball uphill.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it takes patience, takes what we're doing, and thank you for allowing us to share this message, education, mm-hmm. and to get everybody involved. And that, a lot of people say, well, that's pretty naive, Jim. Well, I'm going to remain naive, because I do believe that we can help people, and you can connect, when I say that, connect the heart and the head. We just got to mm-hmm. figure out a way to connect that heart right. and the head. And to be able to give people opportunities. And from my story and my background, I know what it's like. I love just getting out in the community. Mm-hmm. I can relate. I can mm-hmm. put on my boots. I understand. Mm-hmm. I can have a conversation. And then the nice thing, then I can maybe put on a different set of jeans and different jacket and go talk to board members or talk to investors and say, don't ignore it. I know it is a challenge, but just don't ignore. The private sector, we can do more for this country than any government program out there. So so we're sitting on this money, but it's not easy. I don't give a flip answer to people that ask that question because it's not easy. But we do it, and we got to start someplace.
You know, and it is difficult because if say you know business. Amazon, shall we say, you know, I was going to say business A, but we'll just, you know, you know, they clearly want to go into an area that has a good infrastructure. You know, you talk in your book about some of the areas. I mean, Flint, Michigan would probably be one of the biggest examples of this, where when the area gets depressed, the entire infrastructure goes. You don't have good water. You don't have good sewer. You don't have, you know, a lot of things. And so, you know, companies like, oh, why would we want to go there? Plus, they want, depending on what they do, an educated workforce. You know, for some, high school is fine. For some, you know, you might need some highly skilled, say, engineers, you know, people like that. And what's going to draw those people to the community are the amenities, the, you know, the movie theaters, you know, all of those things. And if you're going out into, say, rural Arkansas, you're going to lose those things. But, you know, as I was reading your book, one of the things that I was thinking about, and you know, this is purely anecdotal because there just hasn't been enough time to even go through this, is I think the pandemic is changing this.
It is.
I saw something or heard something, and this was on news, and it was on news that I trusted, you know, because there are those out there. We all know about that. But they were talking about the fact that so many people now are first, they're going, well, hey, if I'm having to work from home, I can do that anywhere. I don't have to be in this big city with the pollution, with the traffic, with all of those things. I might really want to go to rural America. As long as I've got internet, you know, I'm fine. And I think we have companies that are doing that too. You know, they're thinking, you know, we don't have to be, you know, we can move out. So I think probably the next year is really going to be interesting because unfortunately, you know, as we kind of alluded to, we're going to have more poverty that comes out. I mean, the haves and the have-nots they're going to get further apart. You know, but at the same point, I think there really are going to be so many opportunities. You know, you hate to see so many people out of work, but that does give opportunity for people to say, hey, you know, we're going to start this business here, you know, and or move our business there or open a factory or whatever it is, you know, because there's a lot of different opportunities that are going to happen. And I think a lot of people really are going to say, I'm done with the city. I just don't want to be here anymore.
No, I agree. And I have seen a shift since March along those lines. And I am doing it in my own businesses. I just hired a phenomenal mechanical engineer, a PE, from a rural community in Pennsylvania and for our operation in Yuma, Arizona.
There's this little thing called Zoom. you don't have to be in the same place.
Absolutely. So those dynamics are shifting. And so if we look at one of we're talking about the rural areas and we look at the demographics there and we got to understand the educational level, any rural area we go, we have some people, we have DNA.
Right.
So we got to determine and to share with them, this is what we can do. This will allow us to help you do a job. Oh, by the way, as you say, geez, a business that's trying to set up in this particular, well, I need this high-tech, high-falutin engineers or the finance or the marketing. Yes, we do. Well, like you said, guess what? This thing called Zoom is going to help us do that. Remote working is going to allow us to do that, but we can still establish what's referred to as the QOZ business. In other words, qualified opportunity business, because there's some very strict guidelines from the Treasury.
I mean, we're talking IRS here, and they're, you know, we might all kind of scoff about lots of things in the government, but the IRS, you know, they're a different entity.
Absolutely. So there are opportunities, and I think we got a huge. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited, even though I wake up every morning and we turn on the news and I get, like a lot of us, pretty depressed over some of the things, which we'll just let that be for the moment. There's opportunity. We can change the framework and the face of America right now.
Right.
And as a result, unfortunately, this pandemic, and I often tell people, you don't have to cut your hand or your finger to know it's going to hurt. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it
will heal.
It will heal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's it. It will heal.
You know, and the other thing about the technology and things, you know, now we're not limited just U.S. You know, we can be hiring workers. We can, you know, get investors from around the world. You know, all of these various things. We're not talking about, okay, well, we're going to move a call center to somewhere else. I mean, you know, that's different. Why not move the call center back here?
Exactly.
And, you know, it's interesting. Many years ago, I worked for a company that moved their call center to South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And it was like, really? We're moving to South Dakota? Well, they got tax benefits. I mean, you know, back to the IRS. There's those funny things. But part of the reason they picked that location, there's a military base there.
Right.
And there were a whole bunch of spouses who needed something to do. And typically, you know, you're on a base for, you're assigned there for a year or so. So, you know, the turnover was there, but not huge. And so it was a great benefit. Plus, you know, their cost of benefits was fairly low because they had, you know, the spouse had military benefits. But, you know, so I think a lot of companies can think about that. And I mean, yeah, I mean, you can answer a phone from anywhere. We've all seen that, right? Mm-hmm. The other benefit that I'm really seeing is all of this online education that is really starting to take place. You know, and so say you start a company in, you know, some more remote area, but you figure, you know, we need to get a different education level. Fine. Everybody takes online courses, you know, through wherever they need. And, you know, and these are courses from, say, Georgia Tech, you know, from all of these schools that they're very good, very qualified schools. So as a company, if you're supporting that, that's just phenomenal.
Yeah, I agree, and I love your views, Deb. I am such an educational. I support education.
You have a PhD. I have two masters. So you know, we're just one of those people. We just go back to school and go back to school
with the intent. I actually want to learn. I'm curious. I want to learn. How can I get better? How can I learn? And we have a program at our companies where we have my own curriculum that I've built over the years. Mm-hmm. All of the soft skills, hard skills, and we have online portals. Mm-hmm. And all of our employees are given access to that for free. We do it in English and Spanish and any other thing we want to do because, as I say, I have the pleasure to address my employees. I said, you know, I hope your career is going to be here, but if it's not, this education that we're affording you, nobody can take it away from you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So take advantage of it. Take advantage. And so we are, we're always supporting that. Mm-hmm. And like I said, in the QOZs, the same thing can happen. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we talk about the rule. There's no excuses anymore.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, you mentioned where you grew up. Well, I grew up in the mountains of Colorado, you know, elevation 8,000 feet. You know, I laugh at Georgia when they say, oh, we have mountains. I'm like, no,
nah.
You know, Georgia does not have mountains. We got hills. but in a very, it was a very remote area, completely surrounded by mountains. We had to go over a mountain pass to get out, which meant during the winter, we got really isolated. You know, and the closest major grocery store, you know, we had a little small town one, but the closest major grocery store, the closest doctor, the closest hospital, 65 miles away, over a mountain pass. You know, and so, you know, education when I was in school, I mean, there, the internet had not been invented. I'm that old. And so, you know, it really was, if you wanted an education past high school, you had to leave. Right. That was, you know, and the fact now that you don't have to do that, I mean, that's just incredible. You know, but I look at, say, you know, where I grew up. I mean, I had 32 in my graduating class, and that was the whole county. You know, and that was a very large class. I mean, last year, I think they had 8. But, you know, it is still a very, I don't want to say depressed, but it is, it's a fairly depressed community. But it, you know, the interesting thing is, of course, you know, people move there on purpose because they want that lifestyle. You know, they don't want to be in the big cities. And you know, again, I come back to the fact that, you know, now we're in this pandemic. People are thinking, I don't want to live in the big city anymore, or at least I don't want to live downtown. I don't want those commutes. You know, it's, I think this really is, as we've been saying, going to cause some pretty dramatic changes.
Yeah, it is. And if I may, as talked about the urban centers, where we have the exit.
Right.
And I mean, this is certainly, as we all know, in March, New York, city of New York and Connecticut.
Right. When you shut down New York City, holy schmoly.
Right. Exactly. And that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of folks that are leaving the city. So we've got to have that balance as well. And that's also another opportunity to say, no, this will pass. We just can't throw everything away and leave our urban centers either. And then within the opportunity zone rules, it'd be surprising. Since we're talking about the Manhattan area, the Brooklyn Navy Shipyard, and parts of that's an opportunity zone, right? So there's really room for growth there because we got people leaving the city. We understand it. We got to stabilize those. We got people in the rural communities that needs more jobs. We can stabilize that. So it's to me it's a one huge balancing act of the problem that we can solve, especially if we can to be consistent in our regulations from Treasury.
Right.
And one of the challenges for the QOZ initiative is sometimes they change it too much. It makes it difficult for...
Yeah, it is. It does get political on occasion, right?
It's very political gets very political and it's hard to make long-term decisions if somebody's going to make a knee-jerk reaction, right?
Right. Right. And especially if you're thinking of moving or opening a big business. I mean, you know, that's not something that you're thinking, hey, this is going to be a year or two. We're talking 10, 20 years, you know, some things like that. But, you know, one of the things that I'm also curious about is, you know, we've been talking about moving or establishing a business.
Right.
What if you're just somebody who wants to invest but doesn't have the checkbook that Bill Gates does? You know, what are the opportunities for, you know, everyday people?
Yeah, boy, I love your question.
I'm a smart kid.
One of the things that I wanted to accomplish in our fund, PhD Opportunity Fund, and we got Fund 1, 2, 3, got a lot of different funds in the play. I wanted to be able to make it available to anybody on the street to be able to participate, to be able to say it's within our reach. So a lot of our funds, we set up the investments, and I know this number is still going to sound high to a lot of people, but a minimum investment like $50,000. In our world, that's not major.
That's pretty small.
Pretty small, right? And I did that because I wanted to, like you said, if somebody said that, I just got a call yesterday from an investment advisor mm-hmm. that's represented this couple and said they saw what we were doing mm-hmm. and they got $300,000 of capital gains mm-hmm. and they want to mm-hmm. Spread that around. And they'd mm-hmm. like to put $50,000 in our fund because they just love what we're doing. And they feel this is the fund. But invite them in. Where they could just be there side by side mm-hmm. the big guys, if mm-hmm. you will, the big person, right? Mm-hmm. So we're trying to do that. Mm-hmm. It's difficult from a fund because it is a small amount because right. a lot of these this project.
But if you get a bunch of those, then you've got a big amount.
Yeah, exactly. This project in Salinas is over $200 million investment, right? Mm-hmm. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. But we're still trying to find ways for people to be able to, from Main Street, mm-hmm. to get involved in it.
Right. You know, and I mentioned also before when we were chatting before we started the program, you know, I have had several different people on my program who are Amazon third party vendors. Mm-hmm. And you know, right now they outsource whatever their product is, mm-hmm. usually to China. You know, let's mm-hmm. just be honest, that's where that happens. And for a variety of reasons, they'd like to bring it closer. You know, it is obviously much easier to manage inventory when it's not having to go across an ocean. You know, that really is one of the biggest drawbacks, especially if you're not, you know, producing enough that you have an entire boat. You know, if you're having to get just cargo space and you're having to wait for that, that's just a difficult thing. So to me, I see this as a great opportunity for maybe some businesses to combine and, you know, and that's the thing, you know, they might not be able to run 24/7 by themselves or anything like that, or even, you know, just a day shift. But if they start combining with other companies, then that might be where they can really go, you know what, we can bring this business back into the United States.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. That is an opportunity. Where, like I said, you could combine, mm-hmm. you could make a presentation mm-hmm. to a fund that has interest and look at building a manufacturing facility that could be shared mm-hmm. with some right. like that and to be right. leased like that. Mm-hmm. And actually, some of the things that we're looking at, mm-hmm. that we are actively looking for that. We're because our focus right now is on the industrial side mm-hmm. Because, again, trying to create jobs
right.
From the industrial mm-hmm. side. So we're looking at that as we speak. Mm-hmm. And before we started the program, we were talking about Birmingham, for example, mm-hmm. Birmingham, Alabama. Well, Birmingham, Alabama, they have called Opportunity Alabama. Mm-hmm. And I was just talking to them last week. About some of the rural areas, mm-hmm. especially for stone fruit, right? Mm-hmm. Stone fruit. Mm-hmm. And I just point that out because mm-hmm. we're always looking and mm-hmm. there's these co-ops mm-hmm. that we could do. So for all of your third party Amazon, I would mm-hmm. say, folks, we have an opportunity right. and we should take a serious look at it. Right. And give me a call. Mm-hmm.
Right. And of course, you know, when you've got the facility and the workers and the technology, you right. know, this is way out of my realm of knowledge, but it for many things, it's probably pretty easy to shift what you're producing, especially because of the technology, you know? So if it's say a plant that does plastic items, you know, it doesn't matter if you're doing kitchen house, you know, items as opposed to, you know, shelving or whatever. Plastic's plastic. You just change what you're making. And so that's where you say, okay, well, you know, this week, this company is going to you know, be on our production line. I mean, that's how these big companies work anyway. And then it just makes it easy to switch around.
And that falls into the realm, what we refer to as contract manufacturing now. Mm-hmm. And of course you have it. And then you've got your different molds and the mm-hmm. technology. But yes, that can be done. And right. Huge. Yeah.
And especially when you start figuring in AI and you know, a lot of other things, which, I mean, you know, again, I mean, things are just growing so rapidly and we're able to see so many things. You know, it's slowed down right now. We'll be honest. It's, you know, it's just slowed down. But I like the analogy of, you know, you cut yourself. It hurts. It bleeds. But somehow it heals, you right. know, is good or bad, it does heal. And then you go on, you know, with either a little scar or a big scar, but you go on.
Right. Yeah. And that's what we must do in this COVID-19. Mm-hmm. We're in pain. Mm-hmm. I'm red, white, and blue. I love this country. It gave me so many.
You are an army guy. I mean, yeah.
I'm an army guy. Mm-hmm. I love, and the opportunity that I say that she has afforded us, she, the United States, mm-hmm. has afforded mm-hmm. us, is just tremendous. And the future is bright.
Right. Well, I mean, even if you just look now at companies that within 6 months have made major, we'll use the term of the day, pivots, right. to do something that you know they 6 months ago they never would have thought they were doing, and now it's phenomenal what they're doing, right. You know, and they're taking advantage of those opportunities, and unfortunately there will be many that can't. You know, the hospitality industry is probably one of the biggest examples of that, but you know, that's where you have to think of something different. I mean, you know, there's a restaurant near us that, you know, sit down restaurant, fairly fancy restaurant, they built a drive through. You know, and now obviously their menu is much more limited on the drive through because you're not going to sit out there for, you know, 15 minutes waiting. But yeah, they were like, people aren't coming in. We still want to be in business. You know, they've been doing takeout, they've been doing delivery, but they put drive through. So, you know, all of these various things, when people stop and think, how can we do it differently? I think that's where we're really going to see the opportunities come.
I absolutely agree. And you mentioned drive-through, and I know we're very short on time. I just reminded, is the Varsity still in existence?
It is. The Varsity is. They've opened back up to, you know, some partial type of seating, you know, and but yeah, the Varsity is still here. I think the Varsity that's at the airport might still be closed just because, you know, the airport is, you know, much more limited. But, yep, the Varsity is still here. You can still go down and you know, get your hot dogs. And the orange drink they're not selling anymore. That caused a big to-do. But yeah, Varsity is still here. And for anybody listening, just check it out. Just Google Atlanta Varsity and you'll find out what we're talking about.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time there. A lot of hot dogs.
All right, because it's across from Georgia Tech. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, exactly.
And like mounds of French fries, right? We made the mistake the first time going there of each one of us ordering French fries. It was like, okay, we got enough French fries for 20 people.
We do.
Well, Dr. White, this really has been fascinating. And we've just scratched the surface on this. I'd love maybe in 6 months to, you know, 12 months to, because things hopefully will have settled down more and we'll know a little bit more. Obviously, the election will have taken place. Right. So, you know, that's going to be a big determining factor. You know, love or hate, whoever that is going to, you know, going to change things. And so the election will have taken place. The pandemic will have hopefully calmed, not just here, but worldwide. So I'd love to have you on again to talk about, you know, a lot of new opportunities. But until then, how do people find you and get in contact with you?
PhTOpportunityFund.com, PhTOpportunityFund.com. Mm-hmm. And they could also, if they're interested in the books that mm-hmm. we have, go to authorjimwhite.com. Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, the book that I read for the program, and you have to hold it up because I just have the digital version, is Opportunity Investing, How to Revitalize Urban and Rural Communities with Opportunity Funds. And it really was a very interesting book. You know, lots of great things in there that really make you go,
Good. I'm glad. And as you know, I also included in part four of the book was more about running companies and how you start companies.
Yeah, you talk about the circle of success. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So cool. Well, you know, until we chat again, do you have any final words that you want to leave everyone with?
My final words is this will pass. This is the COVID-19. Keep the faith. It's keep the faith and just keep the faith. It's we got a lot of pain in the country, but that's. That's what makes us so great. We always overcome. So
great. I love it. Well, I'm Deb Creer. I've been having just an absolutely fascinating discussion with Dr. Jim White. And until next time, everyone have a great day.
Tune in for our next program for even more trends, best practices, and techniques for how to make your business a success. The Business Power Hour, hosted by Deb Creer, is proud to be part of the C-Suite Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.